My talk will be on the Queen Title, and it's subtitled Power, Patronage, and Personality. To give you a little bit of a background on my own experience with Tudor history, I studied my undergraduate with Oxford, and I did Tudor history for my first semester. I then specialized more in French history and religious history, and actually American history towards the end. But my postgraduate was at Queen's University in Belfast, where I studied medieval history, and did my dissertation on Catherine Howard's household and the nature of the Queen's household in what's now known as the early modern period and used to be known as the late medieval period. But after you get longer in time, you start changing the categories. But what was the Queen's Household? In a nutshell, the Queen's Household was a group that surrounded the Queen Consort. Basically like the presidential staff. Then if you're familiar with the West Wing, any characters who surround the First Lady were roughly comparable to the staff that surrounded the Queen Consort in early modern England. The difference was that the Queen Consort was not just regarded in early modern England as an appendage to her husband in the way the First Lady might be, and take on various causes. The Queen Consort was regarded as literally the First Lady of the kingdom. It was her job to take young aristocratic women under her wing and to find them husbands. It was her job to be the kind of arbiter of good taste, the arbiter of aristocratic morality. It was her job to be a baby machine, and it was also her job to kind of be the biggest housewife of her generation. She stood at the center of a vast economic network of estates, rents, tithes, taxes that flowed right into her hands, and on the one hand funded her very lavish lifestyle, and the other also went to her servants, all of whom she was expected to pay for, and her charities, her religious payments to the masses, to the souls of her dead brothers. This was a huge economic undertaking. And the Queen Consort, in fact, in early modern England, had quite a lot of financial independence from her husband. Henry tried to reduce that slightly because female independence is not an idea he's in favour, but they do have a great amount of land, and when we come to talk about the men who serve them, you will see this is almost like the CEO or committee of a company rather than a sorority, which is often how it's presented in the media. If you think about the role that even ladies played, if you look at things like the other Boleyn girl, the Virgin Queen, the Tudors, ladies and leading are often shown to be gorgeously dressed, giggling, whispering behind their fans and flitting around behind their mistresses. In fact, they had very real jobs and duties. The jobs and duties they were eligible to perform under Tudor law were directly linked to their ancestry. How blue is your blood is basically how high can you go in the Queen's household. It's that ruthless. Lots of fighting and bitching going on about who's descended from a duke in the male line, who's descended from a marquis in the female line, and which is higher, and whose blood is purer. It's a real obsession for these people to prove they are pure ancestry. No one wants to be tarred with a new money brush. But one thing that emerged in my own research that really struck me as so interesting, well, and I hadn't expected to go down this route of gender history at all, is there is a real, real fear and resentment in Henry's court about the Queen's household from the male courtiers. What are these women doing when the doors close and there are no men there? Because women are supposed to be ruled by their husbands, they're supposed to be ruled by their fathers, they're supposed to be ruled by their priests, they're supposed to be ruled by men. So what happens when the doors close at the end of the night and they have to undress the queen and they're all in a room where there's no masculine authority? And incredibly, what I discovered was that even male members of the Queen's household staff were writing letters sniping about this. and saying, oh, you know, if you think they actually care about men, don't be fooled. Because the moment you leave, it's free for all. There's a real vicious, paranoid suspicion of what the ladies and women are up to that leads, I think, inexorably to the death of Catherine of Howard, and certainly does not help Anne Boleyn or Catherine of Aragon. All three of them, in fact, or Catherine Parr, four of his wives are really stung by this fear. And it was bizarrely their own vice chamberlain who helped fan the flames, who we'll come on to. I'll come on to various views and all the rest of it, but to give you an idea of the size of the household, it's largely likely throughout Henry's time. Catherine of Aragon has a household staff of 160 to look after her. Anne Boleyn goes up to 250 ballpark. James Seymour brings it down to 200, and then James Seymour dies. When it's 1539, Henry's starting to reconvene the household because he's about to marry Anne Boleyn, he says no. The number is now 139. And this produces en masse panic amongst the blue gloves, of course. They're not going to get their old jobs back. Anne Bassett, who is the daughter of a very fishy socialite mother, Lady Lyle, is sent with a big pot of quince marmalade to the king, saying, would you mind finding me and my sister here at the court? Conveniently, Anne Bassett manages to plead for herself, but forgets her sister, and says that his grace did like your marmalade most marvellous well, but I dare not ask him for another favour in fear of how he take it, which I take to mean she didn't really like her sister and didn't want her stealing her thunder. But Anne got her place because of Quince marmalade, which seems incredible, but marmalade was the way to grease the path, apparently. It's the kind of identity of curdled sugar is always going to be your way of winning his favour. Part of the reason why he may have shrunk the numbers a little bit, I'll talk about later, but it may have been that he was astute enough to realise that a foreign princess, Anne Cleves, would bring in so many of her own servants, the numbers would swell. These are, just to be clear, there are two types of servants for a queen, upstairs, downstairs. Upstairs are the chief officers and the chief ladies in waiting. They're the blue bloods. Downstairs are your cooks, your scullions, your butlers, your maids, the people who do all the heavy lifting, the sweating and the toiling. We know almost nothing about them. It may be that they're how the numbers fluctuate so much, you know. Let's say Tim, the fellow servant, and his brothers, if I don't have a job, well, come in, no one will notice. The queen will pay for you anyway. Because the queen has to pay for all of her servants. If you're a duchess and you serve her, you get three rooms, two butlers, three other servants, and a pet dog, and a horse. And the queen pays for that. And every winter, she gives you three faggots of firewood for your fireplace, three joints of meat, bottles of wine, and bottles of beer. And it goes, and then if you're a marchioness, which is one below a duchess, you get two faggots of wood, so you have to be slightly colder. And it literally goes down that way for every rank of your ancestry. But if you imagine, say, Madame Boleyn having 250 servants, the money the Queen's household was expending was enormous. And Anne herself not exactly had cheap taste when it came to jewellery and clothing, so that also added up. When Beth is here, if you look at the cloth of gold, Anne loves cloth, gold and cloth of silver, and felt no need to deny herself such treats. So the money was really pouring out of the royal treasury for this. These are a list of the Queen's Council, the Queen's servants above there, her male servants who have to take care of her household. So she had the Lord Chamberlain, who was always the highest of highest of blue bloods, nothing less than an earl. Duke, Marquess, Earl are the three highest titles in the English aristocracy. The Lord Chamberlain was technically in charge of everything. He is the CEO. In reality, he does almost nothing. And it's the Vice Chamberlain, who is usually a member of the lower aristocracy, his deputy, who does all the work and gets half the pay. Under Catherine of Aragon, her Lord Chamberlain was the Earl of Ormond, who spent half a year in Ireland because he was an Irish aristocrat, and the Vice Chamberlain of all the work. The vice chairman is very interesting in this pair because it's a man called Edward Bainton, who becomes Captain American, vice chairman, and serves all six of the wives. He is an extraordinarily unpleasant individual. If I can punch someone from history, he'd certainly be in my top 10. Edward Bainton, B-A-Y-N-O-T-N. Bainton shared Anne Boleyn's religious scruples. He married Catherine Howard's sister Isabel, and he betrayed them both. When the government came looking for people to provide evidence against Anne Boleyn, he offered to personally bully some of her maids himself and gave the names of people she was close to. But he died in addition to the war in France in 1544, so all well with that as well. The Lord Steward is in charge of wages and the allocations of the fact that the fire was beneath the wine. And the Master of the Horse, Elizabeth I was very close to her Master of the Horse, Robert Dudley, is a very prime position. Queens spend all their time out hunting. So to pick the horse and to go with her, a very prestigious post. The Queen's private secretary answers all her correspondence. Then you have a solicitor and an auditor. Again, if you think of the amount of money that is coming in from the Queen's estate, the Queen owned about a tenth of the land in England and Wales in the 1540s. So that's a huge amount, and the rest is supposed to pay for her. And in fact, Prince Charles still gained a lot of his income today from the Duchy of Cornwall. That's how it was set up. Your four gentlemen ushers, whose job it is to open the door and say, begging Your Majesty's pardon, but with Your Majesty's permission, her grace the Marchioness of Exeter to see Your Majesty. The Queen says, the Queen nods. He steps back and says, Her grace the Marchioness of Exeter to see Your Majesty, and shows them it. That's when the gentlemen ushers them. The gentleman in waiting, butlers. The Queen's cupbearer does exactly what it says in the tin. He will stand next to her with a plate and her silver goblet as she sits at lunch. A clerk of the Queen's council, all these men will meet up about once a week, once a fortnight, sit down and discuss the Queen's finances. The clerk will keep all of the records. Catherine Howard has a very punch-happy clerk of the council who beats up five of her family's rival servants and ends up in state prison, and Catherine is so embarrassed that she pretends that she doesn't know what the fact he worked for. A clerk of the wardrobe, sometimes known as the master of the jewels. Now that doesn't sound like a particularly masculine job, it sounds like a stylist thing. But Thomas Seymour was Catherine Howard and Anne Cleves, master of the jewels. If you think about the fabrics the Queens are wearing, a single dress could be worth a working class family's annual income. The clothes are worth an extraordinary amount. Pearls are seeded through them, velvet, silk, satin, and the jewels themselves are worth an extraordinary amount of money. So it's actually usually the gist of men who become the master of the jewels. Again, in the same way that Lord Chamberlain does nothing, the master of the jewels lock him up at the end of the night, but in the daytime he hands him over to the lady in waiting. His job it is to stand next to the Queen as she gets dressed and say, Your Majesty, what jewels this evening? Emeralds, sapphires, pearls, all of the above, if you're Catherine Howard. You have two chaplains, one to say the Queen's personal prayers, who Anne Boleyn is very close to both of her chaplains, Father Skip and Father Parker. Another one, an almoner, to distribute charities to the poor. In the Queen's name. 12 yeomen at the chamber, that's the Queen's private bodyguard. 4 footmen, dog bodies. 7 sumpter men, whose job it is to flip the Queen's mattress. Which gives you an idea of the size of the mattress they were flipping. And obviously the tutors moved around their palaces a lot. The sumpter men took the ladies and waiting mattresses and the Queen and moved them. And they have to make sure the feathers were always fresh and the tassels were always sure and new. So the sumpter men had big muscles and a keen eye for detail. 2 littermen who carried the Queen around when walking was no longer Her Majesty's thing to do. And 17 grooms who are basically messenger boys. So this is just the male above stairs half of the household.
Littermen carried her on a litter?
They can carry her on a litter, or they would, it depends on which queen. If she didn't want to move around the palace, they would carry her on a litter, or they would organize the donkey pulls litter. They would be in charge of getting the horse to pull it. Because the carriage hadn't really come in yet. They were in charge of things like the pillows and the drapes and the sweetmeats and everything to go in the litter. Yeah. Right. The Queen's women. There were several ranks of ladies in waiting. You have the fifth great lady, the four ladies of the Privy Chamber, the nine ladies of exalted rank, the five maids of honour, a mother of the maid, and five chambermaids, or chamberers, as they're called. I'm going to brief discussion of what these women did. The fifth great lady, it has to be said, after a year and a half of studying them, even I am not entirely sure what it was they were supposed to be doing. They are the bluest of blue bloods. They are often related to the royal family, duchesses, marchionesses, countesses. They don't actually live on the Queen's hospitality. They're usually so highly exalted they have many households of their own within the palace. And their job is to accompany the Queen on the great version of great state occasions. Ambassadorial receptions, coronations, christenings, funerals, that kind of thing. The Countess of Oxford was one of Anne Boleyn's, and it was her job to hold a bow in case the Queen wants to spit anything out at her coronation banquet. But the Countess of Oxford was not the attend Anne Boleyn on a day-to-day basis. The four ladies of the Privy Chamber, the nine ladies of the Gold Crown, the maids of honour, the mother of the maids, and the five chambermaids, I'll come to you in a minute. So to give you an idea of who the six great ladies might have been, I'll show you the six who were Anne Cleves great ladies. The first one was Lady Margaret Douglas, the King's niece. Now that portrait is usually given as a portrait of Catherine Howard. I'm not really sure who it is, but an old tutor of mine, firmly, but Susan Brigham, believes it was Margaret Douglas, who I thought in deference to her and then for no other courses of Margaret Douglas to just make her look like she bought a whole bakery. This was the kind of thing to show. Margaret was the daughter of the King's Scottish sister. So she was born herself in Scotland, and like all good Celtic Catholics, she behaved riotously for the first 25 years of her life. She had an extremely strong weakness for any good-looking men in tight, particularly if they're serving the powers. She tried to marry two of them, and on both occasions her uncle the King locked her up. But once she was 27, she decided, I'm no longer going to be this party girl, and reinvented herself as a prim, proper Catholic matron, and not she ever been anything else. When Anne Cleves came to the throne, Margaret Douglas was still very much in her then type is. So she was a wild living gal who had tried to marry Anne Boleyn's uncle and ended up in the Tower for a period of it. Her husband had died. Margaret had bounced back and had now her sights set on Catherine Howard's brother. Things did not end overly well. The second great lady is Mary Fitzroy, the Dowager Duchess of Richmond, who is the Duke of Norfolk's daughter and had actually married the King's illegitimate son. Catherine Brandon, the Duchess of Suffolk, and she was actually the most attractive of the bunch there. Liked to play cards with the Queen, which flipped in and out. Her main interest was Protestantism. She was a very devout convert to the new religion by this stage. Eleanor Manners, the Countess of Rutland. We don't actually know much about the Countess of Rutland. She's been leading a career lady in waiting and didn't care about the King's chop and change attitude to her employer. Mary Radcliffe, the Countess of Sussex, served Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, and Anne Cleves, but very interestingly left when Catherine Howard became Queen and joined the service of Mary Tudor, who she remained a lady-in-waiting to for the rest of her life. And having said this, you've seen there are all the members of the royal family, duchesses, countesses. The sixth one was Lady Elizabeth Clinton, who you probably know as Bessie Blunt, and the King's old mistress. She being brought back to court almost certainly because the king felt sorry for her because her husband had died and so had her illegitimate son. But she was by no means aristocratic enough to warrant a great lady position under normal circumstances. The big three ladies are therefore really the eye candy of the Queen's household. They are only there on the big, big occasions. They're not there on day to day. They maybe play cards, go for a picnic. There's not a lot of interaction with them. And interestingly, no great lady in living is ever indicted, ever questioned about the actions of a queen in disgrace. Anne Boleyn, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, Catherine Parr, none of their great women are questioned. It's the next rank down, the four ladies of the Privy Chamber, who are usually questioned. The ladies of the Privy Chamber, there are four in number, and they are the women who serve the Queen in the bedroom. They undress her, they dress her, they comb her hair, they prepare her bath, they fetch her jewels, they fetch her clothes, they talk to her as she goes through the length of getting dressed in the morning. They are by and also one will always see the suit that the Queen says. The Queen is never without one of the four ladies of the Privy Chamber. And a resounding historical example of why Anne Boleyn was probably innocent and Catherine Howard was probably guilty is that one of Catherine Howard's ladies of the Privy Chamber was executed along with her for facilitating her adultery, and none of Anne Boleyn's were. If you were discreet, like this lady who is often labeled as Catherine Howard, and I can assure you on my life, soul, blood, bone, and marrow, the kitten, she's almost certainly Jane Seymour. That nose is a Seymour nose. And she was the 40-year-old and too ugly. And Catherine Howard was a lady at the Privy Chamber, she was four of Henry's wives. So if you were discreet and kept your head down, you could certainly do it. But usually when you become queen, you appoint your best friend as the lady of the Privy Chamber. You want people around you you can trust. Anne Boleyn appoints Margaret Lee, who lives about 10 or 15 miles from here. You want close friends, because you obviously don't want to be surrounded in those intimate moments by people that you don't particularly like. The next one, the nine ladies of exalted rank. The nine ladies of exalted rank are basically our more stereotypical ladies of women. The ones who sew with the Queen, sing with the Queen, gossip behind fans with the Queen. This is the only one here who served all six, Lady Anne Herbert. She's a maid of honour to Catherine Barragan, Lady Lyddington, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, in charge of Catherine Howard's jewel, and Catherine Parr's sister. So she's the only one who made it through all six. But then ladies of the nine ladies of exalted rank, as long as you have some dose of blue blood by marriage or work, ancestry, you are eligible. The maids of honour, Catherine Howard's aristocrat Lady Elizabeth Fitzgerald, she's the daughter of the Earl of Kildare, Gerald von Fitzgerald. She came to court as a maid of honour to Catherine Howard, and she was saved. Usually speaking, maids of honour are about 10 or 11, maybe a little bit older, maybe a little bit younger. Queens, princesses, bend the rules that suit them. They are supposed to be unmarried aristocratic virgins, and it's the Queen's job to raise them and to be fine aristocratic women and to find good husbands and the same kind of matchmake for them. One of the reasons why Catherine Howard criticized so strongly is because she felt she had set a bad example. Her maid of honor, and in fact, she allowed one of her maids of honor called Dorothy Gray to have nocturnal extracurricular activities with Catherine Parr's brother, William, which obviously spoiled the virgin's work on the marriage market. If you have heard stories of Elizabeth I's beating, her ladies and laying her maids of honor when they got romantic, generations of Dewey and idiotic historians have suggested because Elizabeth was sexually frustrated. It's because if Elizabeth could not guarantee her maids of honour sexual chastity, she was judged a failure in her society by. The maids of honour was strictly controlled, and in fact they had a mother of the maid, a lady willing to oversaw them in a kind of dormitory-like room. speaking for Colin's sake. And there's one story that you don't really know if it's true or not, but it comes from the French court. Me and the owner would have their hands held out like that by the friend and under the French wing, and a fork would be stabbed into the palm of their hand. And the girls were taught to keep smiling after it was stabbed into them. Could be an urban legend, but knowing the French aristocracy, my money is going to be entirely true.
So there are the Mother of the Maids of Jackson, the five chambermaids. They come to prominence because Catherine Howard were asked to testify against her, but generally speaking, they're commoners, they're often widows. In fact, they're not young, they're usually quite a bit old. But even if they are young, they're given the title of misses in front of them to make them respectable because unmarried women shouldn't be living at the court. Before I finish, I'm going to give you a brief synopsis of what life is like to be under each six. Catherine Morgan, I said, she went on to 1531 because after 1531 she was basically an exile. A quote from Bernard's book on Madame Boleyn, in which he says, on his father's death, Henry had happened to fight the same name as Catherine, his queen. It seems to have been a conventionally satisfactory royal marriage. I'm not a huge fan of the book I've quoted from, but this is a perfect assessment of Catherine of Aragon. The Judy I romanticization of her, all of the saint, is a little intriguing. The Catherine was very much like other queens in the Middle Ages. The main flavor of relationships in her household was that she was the latest. She is the only one of six queens who was very close to her great lady. She only liked to be surrounded by the purest of purely loved. Alison Weir is a huge proponent of the frankly ludicrous idea that Catherine of Aragon upheld moral standards. And she set a good example to her ladies and women. Considering the number who became Henry's mistress, I don't quite know how that theory has been reached. She either was incompetent or she didn't care. So Catherine of Aragon, I think we have to remember, was in charge of the house over 22 years. Things changed. Certainly, she was a personally very devout woman. If anyone's read the book, Rise, Heads, and Visitors, I characterized her a little bit like Lady Marchman. Personally very devout, not 100% aware of what's going on around her. I don't think Chris Fray Diego was Catherine's Spanish confessor when she was a young woman. He's been characterized as her Rasputin. She was very, very close to him, and he's been doing protecting his reputation. He was a lecherous and domineering character, although I'm certain Catherine's attitude to him was the same as the very Alexander to Rasputin. She believed he was a saint, not a lover. Catherine of Aragon was a very traditional queen consort to work for. As long as she did her job in her presence, she didn't bother you too much. I wouldn't get too carried away with the PR machine that she set in motion in 1527 when she painted herself as an icon of Roman womanhood. Conventional, elegant, dignified, not too involved in her service of life, that kind of perfect balance. If you like, she may not have been as heroic as some modern people would like to be in her management of her household, but she was certainly pragmatic and sensible, never get too close to the servant. There's a fine piece of aristocratic advice that echoed throughout the century. And Catherine Lee had to stick to it. This is a quote from the hideous Edward Beaton that I mentioned earlier, the Vice Chamberlain. It's written around the time of Anne Boleyn's coronation. As for pastime in the Queen's Chamber, there was never more. If any of you that being now departed have any ladies that you thought favoured you, and some of them mourned your parting, I can no way perceive the same by their dancing and pastime. If any of you are familiar with the period of Bernard and Walker, this quote has been blown so far out of proportion as to be somewhere around the near space station. Bernard says the phrase "ask for pastime in the Queen's Chamber" refers to promiscuity. The letter was written to Anne Boleyn's brother, and I don't know how things flow in the rest of the world, but I can assure you in Belfast, if you wrote to someone's brother and said your sister's a slut, keep having sex parties in her chamber and he'd be punched repeatedly in the face. He would not write back to someone's brother. He's writing about what he said after half time, after dancing, partying. I knew it could be the same whether dancing and half time. Basically, thinking the thing, all these aristocratic women seem to be acting that they don't care that there are new men here to control them, which is surely absurd and unnatural. Anne Boleyn is by far the most competent socialite of the six. She has been at the court from a very young age, and from very young, how young? Some might say six. There's just no one else in the room with it. But she's certainly been there from a very young age. She is well versed in the need to balance piety with partying. She's young, she's fun-loving, she's glamorous. There's certainly a lot of parties going on. She doesn't know what to do in her prayer books, so she doesn't want to look too impious. But nonetheless, she is also very protective of her ladies and women. We know that she paid one lady in waiting's midwifery bills, and she also lent her £100 when she was in financial difficulty because her husband couldn't know that she gambled or lost the money. So Anne was certainly, in many ways, despite her later education in the Syndicate of Harvey, actually quite an ideal employer to work for. She was particularly good with the men she worked for. She sat the whole lot and she became queen and basically said, I'm the star. Total focus and I'll fire you. Go get ruffled and I'll fire you. Get drunk and I'll fire you. Look unkempt and I'll fire you. And she kept her promise. If you were not turned out to the nines and reflecting like an obedient mirror the glory of Anne Boleyn's glamorous queenship, you were ditched. So I think she was much more hands-on than Catherine of Aragon, but I also think she actually ran a tighter ship. My great hatred in history is people who take the words proposition, preposition, supposed, idea, theory, and foist it onto silence. A quote, for example. It is pure speculation, and yes, it is, that had she lived, Jane Seymour might well have been the most formidable of Henry's wives. She had succeeded in ridding her household of Anne Boleyn's wayward influence, you might ask, by putting two eyes off to the floors, and when vigorously re-establishing the virtuous precept set by Queen Catherine, those virtuous precepts, presumably being looked the other way, or your husband sleeps with your maid. Beneath her outward show of humility, there was still, even though it was confined to the domestic sphere only, even though she was too stupid to apply it politically, a year on the throne had transformed Jane into a pious and godly matron who was fully conscious of her rank and dignity. Fully conscious of her rank and dignity are the only words even remotely accurate in that entire paragraph. And usually I don't criticize other historians because I know it's like to make an error of interpretation. But this woman was no more a pious and godly matron than I am.